This is Hinson Braves. It's December the 9th, 2013, and this is a session in the Ontolog mini-series. The session today is Guide to Reasoning Applications and Use Case and use cases. And this is part of a series that's called Ontology Rules and Logic Programming for Reasoning and Applications. And the co-chairs of this session are me, Hinson Graves, and Ken Baklowski of Northeastern University. Just a little bit about this mini-series. There are a number of sessions. So far, there are 5 scheduled. And this is on page 2 of the charts. And the interesting thing is we have some it's a very interesting series with lots of distinguished participants and interesting material that you can find on the web pages. I just put the star by the session that we're in today, and there's one following early next year and likely more to be scheduled. And so for today's agenda, our real interest in this session is to gain insight into the technical underpinnings of successful mainstream systems that employ reasoning and ontology. So the kind of questions we want to know are what kind of language formations, formalisms are being used, what kind of ontologies, where do they come from, how scalable is all this, how do they deal with the volume of data that they use, and the frequency of events. And, of course, this is more than can be answered in this session, but that's still the kind of things that we would like to know. Not so much the theoretical aspect, but because I think a lot of us are somewhat familiar with that, but understand what is actually making it mainstream. And the panelists that we have today, Arun senses regret, which is, I think, really unfortunate. Jan Zausman, William Boone, and Mitch Kokar. And so now I'll turn it over to Ken to introduce each panelist and moderate from there. Thanks.
Thank you. We've got an excellent collection of speakers, and we will form a panel after the speakers finish their talks. And so let's begin with our first speaker, Jan Zausman. He is coming to us from Franz Incorporated, where he is the president and CEO. This company is a leading supplier of commercial, persistent, and scalable database products, and provide a storage layer for powerful reasoning and ontology modeling capabilities. Today, he's going to be telling us about Prolog rules, reasoning, and sparkling magic in the real world. And so, Jans? So I would just ask that you announce as you go from one slide to the next, so people can follow it. Follow your presentation locally, and also I'll give you a time check at 20 minutes to make sure that we stay on schedule. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. So, can you go to slide 2? So, we are a commercial company. We provide a as most of the people in the audience probably know, a triple store called Allegro Graph. And we have a whole series of interesting mechanisms in our system that people can use in their projects. But what I find is when we start projects with customers that we always get incredibly confused about, they say, what do I do with rules? And what is it what I can do with Prolog? And how does reasoning fit in all of this? And you guys now also have magic predicates that can do things that fall outside of the scope of Sparkle, but you can use in Sparkle. And so people get confused about all these various capabilities that we have. And so I'm kind of happy that I was invited to give this talk here, because then I could put my thoughts a little bit more in line and practice it out on you guys first. Okay, so that is so I'm going to talk first about how all these things fit together for us in projects, and then I'm going to talk about a real use case that we did with the big bank. I'm not allowed to use the name. And in there we have a set of accounts of people that have an online account with a bank. They make payments to each other, and you want to find if certain people in there are fraudulent or not. And so in order to figure that out, we need to do all kinds of interesting graph analytics, temporal reasoning, geospatial analysis. So let me start with the part one, and that is so how do all these concepts like rules, prologue, reasoning, magic, predicates together? So let's go to the next slide. So here you see an overview of the things I'm going to talk about in the next 5 to 10 minutes. So at the left top you see that we have a reasoner, both a dynamic and a materializer. And then we have these magic predicates that you can embed in Prologue and in Sparkle. And then the Sparkle itself, and both the Prologue and the Sparkle can be used in rule-based systems. So let me start with the left top. Can we go to the next slide? Yeah. So we provide two kinds of reasoning. So we have an L2RL materializer, and if you have big data sets and they're pretty static, then when you apply the materializer, and after that, you can do pretty fast reasoning queries over our material. But if you have dynamic applications, for example, we deal with real-time event streams coming in, and these events are of various classes, maybe there's subclass relationships. Well, in that case, you can't use the materializer, and you have to do real-time reasoning. And if you work with billions of triples, then that is actually not always going to be that fast. So when we talk to customers about using the dynamic reasoner, we try to use mostly the subsumption reasoning. We tell people, please don't go overboard with subproperty chains, because especially in healthcare, we've seen these subproperty chains that are 20 levels deep. And then combined with the inverse and transitive relationships, then you put a lot of strain on a dynamic reasoner. So anyway, so we actually can reason with billions of triples, as long as you don't make it too complicated. And so we have these two reasoners, and obviously you can use them or you cannot use them. But if you use them, then both Sparkle and Prologue can use the results of reasoning. So can we go to the next slide? Number five, yes. Yeah, so typically, and everyone in this audience will be familiar with this, but if the reasoner is off, and I would ask in Prologue, give me the type, or give me all the types of yumps. Now in Sparkle, give me the type of yumps. Oops, I made actually a mistake in the Sparkle query. The Q should not be in that query, in that line I see now. Anyway, with reasoning on, I would get the whole stack of classes that I belong to. But what's important to know is that even if you work in Prologue, you can use the reasoner under the hood. Yeah, it's just you get more triples back if you have particular classes. So can we go to the next slide? And so we see that the reasoner can be used both by Prologue and by Sparkle. And then I want to talk about the other thing, and that is magic predicates. So can we go to the next slide? So I don't know if people are familiar with magic properties of predicates, but basically what you have there is that you can use predicates in your Sparkle or in the Prologue 2, and these predicates actually do not really exist in your database, because what we've done is we created functions, and kind of pretty complex functions. And so when you do a Sparkle query and you use one of these predicates, then the Sparkle engine will see one of these predicates and say, hey, this is one that I need to compute. It will do computations. It will return bindings, and then the Sparkle query will continue. But can we go back one slide again? So what you see in this list on the right, So we have magic predicates so that you can, in the Sparkle query, for example, do a call out to Solr. Yeah, so say you store triples and you have a lot of text in your data. Well, some people want to use the Solr functionality for that, so we can store the text in Solr and then link those texts to triples in the tuple store. But in our Sparkle queries, we can combine the two. Same applies to MongoDB. Yeah, we can we have customers that store documents in MongoDB, but the meta information about objects in Allegro Graph. And so in Sparkle queries, you can talk both to the tuple store and to MongoDB. And then we have a whole slew of other things you can do. So you can, in a Sparkle clause, just say, oh, give me all the points that are within 10 miles of this particular point, and you will get a set of bindings back. You can reason about time. You can do very complicated social network queries or graph queries, graph functions straight into a Sparkle thing. And I'll show that later. And we're working on a mechanism to make it very easy for customers to create their own magic predicates. But as is, what this function also shows is that then again, both Sparkle and Prolog can use these functions. And you can write these magic predicates in almost any language. Obviously, we can write them in Lisp, which is the core language underlying our product. If you wanted to write in C, that would be possible too. If you write them in JavaScript, then we can translate those straight into Lisp, compile that, and you create magic predicates that way. And the magic predicates in itself can even be Prolog functions or Sparkle functions. Okay, so go to the next. And to the next again. So here's an example of a Sparkle query with magic predicates. So here you see the query where you find, I can't use my mouse here, I believe. So we find for a person, Sonia, the person who has the email address, Sonia, sorry, I'm chaotic here. Then in the next line that says Ego Group, yeah, what I do is I find all the people three levels deep around this person, Sonia, using the paid relationship. Then in the next line with active degree centrality, I actually compute the importance of each person in the group, and then I start with the most important person. And then for each of these people, I get the email, and then I order by most important. And then you can see it on you can see it here. But so you would get the 10 most important friends in this particular network using a predicate, in this case, paid. Somebody using a slide of my big bank fraud demo that I'm going to do later. Okay, next slide. And if you want to figure out how this all works, then you can go to our website. And you can find all the magic predicates that we've defined so far. So just type in your Google Sparkle magic properties, Allegro Graph, and you get straight to this page. The next one. So now we have the overview picture again of how all these components fit together. So the next thing we're going to talk about is Prolog. Can we go to the next slide? So we're on slide 11 right now. So our database, Allegro Graph, contains a full ISO standard Prolog. People always ask me why you need that, and they said, well, Sparkle is a great, great language, and we're spending a lot of time in our company to make it faster and faster and better and better, but Sparkle is not a programming language, and in many situations where you need to do some look at the sequence of events, and we have functions that need more than two variables, there's an infinite list of why, in some cases, you would just need a full programming language to deal with information in your triple store. Anyway, so we have Prolog for that. And what we see for what our customers do is mostly build up libraries and domains and domain-specific languages specifically tailored to what they're trying to solve. And then in the end, what you'll see is that the queries that they use and the rules are much simpler to read and much simpler to maintain. So can we go to the next slide, slide 12? Yeah. So when I say hierarchy of functors in my previous slide, I mean, for example, something like this. And this is a very simple and silly example, but you get the idea. Yeah. So I start by defining what a male is and a female is. And what you see there in the first line is someone is a male. If in the triple store, Q means in the triple store, there's a person X that has the sex male and female the same for female. So that when I've done that, I can define a father relationship. Yeah, father X Y. If X is a male and X is a child Y, I do the same thing for mother. Then I can do a parent relationship, where you're the father or the mother, and then using the parent relationship, I can start doing a recursive relationship, like an ancestor relationship. And given our audience, I don't have to explain this. You guys all get this. But this is what you can do. You can build up a hierarchy of functions that are more and more abstract and more powerful. And then in the end, your queries look much better. So can we go to the next? 13. So this is a real-world example where we are tracking persons of interest that move around the country, that potentially try to attack certain targets. And so we have an evidence-based, rule-based system that runs potentially hundreds of rules after every so many events or every 5 minutes. Here's a rule 6, which you see here, where you say, well, a person of interest has a partner through closeness. And then we start and we say the most recent event for this person of interest is this event. Now, most recent event, I don't know if people in the audience have ever worked with events in a database or in a graph database or tuple store. It's always very expensive and it takes a few lines to just define what the most recent event is. So we just created something special so we can find the most recent event in a microsecond. So that is the first magic. Well, this is a simple version, and then you say for this event, give me the location. Then we say, well, give me all the other locations that are within, that are nearby my location, yeah, within 3 miles. And then you look whether this other event is also a most recent event, and if that's the case, find the actor for the event, and then suggest that this that the person of interest gets an extra danger point. Now, I'm not going to go through all these rules, but what I want to show you here is that if I would have done this in native Sparkle, for example, this would have been probably 30, 40 lines of code. And with this, I can, in Prolog, kind of keep it pretty, pretty small and readable. Okay, can we go to the next? So then finally about how we can use both Prolog and Sparkle to create rule-based systems, and there are actually two that we've used. Mostly we've used evidence-based rule systems, and we're currently working on a preference-based rule system. But let's go to the next slide and talk about evidence-based rules. Yeah. So our rules can be written both in Prolog or Sparkle. I just give you an example of one of these rules. Basically, what you have is a situation where events come in at a particular rate, and you almost want to do something like complex event handling. And so after every few seconds or every so many events, you apply literally hundreds of rules to figure out if anything changed. And in our evidence-based system, what we usually do is we add or subtract points from a hypothesis or the danger level of an entity or the threat level or a particular potential target. And then we just, okay, so what we do is at any point in time, we know, for example, how dangerous an entity is or what extent a target has potential threats. And then recently we also started mixing that with the Bayesian belief network that we interface to Medica so we can say something about probabilities. So that is production rules. Can we go to the next slide, 16? And so what I just explained before is actually these are two rules. Here are two rules that come from one of these rule-based systems. And I don't think I have to go any deeper now. Can we go to the next? Yeah. So now I want to talk about a real use case that we deal with, and it's with the fraud. And so imagine you have hundreds of millions of customers, and these customers send each other money, and sometimes money flows into the the system, and sometimes suddenly a lot of money streams out of the system. Now, one fraudulent pattern that this bank is interested in is collusion. Yeah, and that is where a bunch of people work together to get a large amount of money very quickly out of the system. So can we go to the next slide? Yes, so, and here's a particular pattern that we try to find in the data. For example, we want to find more than 5 accounts that were opened in the last hour, and then go to the next slide, slide 19, where we then see that within 30 minutes that these other accounts are open, large money is paid into these new accounts. Yeah, go continue. Next slide, and then within the next hour, money flows into external accounts and foreign credit cards. Yeah. So now so it looks like there's this new group of people suddenly gets a lot of money and the money instantly flows out of the system. Now, is this fraud or not? Well, you still don't know. So one of you, can we go to the next slide? So the other thing you want to try is these people that just open these accounts, do they have relationships? Yeah. Do they have any kind of cohesion? And so what we can look at is like, was one account opened from the same IP address? If yes, that's kind of pretty suspicious. Or the email addresses that people gave, can we find any other link between them? Or were two accounts maybe opened in the same place? Or did they pay through someone else each other earlier? Anyway, so there's all kinds of ways where you can find potential links between the people that just opened the account. We do the same thing also for the people that paid the money. Yeah, did they trade in the past? Did they maybe indirectly trade in the past? Are they all coming from the same spot? And so this is finding a pattern that like this is not writing one Spark or query or Pro or query to find all this, but it's actually probably 20 rules. Yeah, all working together to ultimately determine whether or not a human being should be alerted for something happening that they should investigate a little bit more. Can we go to the next? So now in order to deal with that and do this analysis, we use a very simple event ontology that we use for in many, many different kinds of projects. And in our ontology, an event has a type. Yeah, so you have a meetings, the subclasses is informal meetings, you have communications events, you have financial transactions, visits, attacks, whatever you can think of. Yeah, so dealing with that, you need a little bit of RDFS++ reasoning. Then we have an event in our projects always have at least one, but most of the time more than one actor. Yeah? So in order to deal with that, to find relationships between people or entities, we need social network analysis. Events always happen at a particular place, and for that we use a geospatial reasoning. Then most events have a start time and sometimes an end time and anything else that describes the event. Next slide. And so these events are everywhere, and given the time, I'm not going in there, but you can imagine that almost anything that happens in life can be turned into events. Next slide, it's slide 24. Yeah. So for our analysis, we use these three libraries. Social network analytics, temporal reasoning, geospatial, and all of that embedded as magic predicates in Prolog and Sparkle. Next one. Next slide, 25.
Jan, this time check, 20 minutes.
Okay, so five more minutes?
5 more minutes.
Okay, I can do that. All right. So in our social network analysis library, we have routines or functions to find out how far one person is from the other and how strong the relationship. We have all kinds of statistics to say something about functions that compute the groups that persons belong to. We can compute how important you are in the group, and we can look at a group as a whole and see whether or not there is a leader in that group. Next slide. Then we have a whole set of functions all described in our website on magic predicates that deal with geospatial. One thing that we're really fast at is that doing proximity search. So you have one particular point, now give me all the things that happen within, say, 5 miles of that point. But we also work with polygons. Next slide, 27. And then we deal with temporal reasoning. So normally, now let me just say, we use Ellen's interval logic and then mostly the qualitative part. And so we wrote simple functors and magic predicates to deal with all the ways that two durations can relate to each other and how points and points can relate, and points and durations can relate to each other. So next slide. And so with all of these things together, we can do queries that until about half a year ago I only could do in Prolog, where I could do something where I said, find all the meetings that happened in December within 5 miles of Berkeley that was attended by the most important person in Jans's friends, and friends of friends. And if you look at this query, you can see, and I'm not going in there, that it uses social network analytics, plain database lookup, some IDFS++, some temporal reasoning, and some spatial reasoning. Yeah, all this in the same paradigm. So next slide. And so I've given the time. I actually hardly can get in there anymore. But as I said, it's a bank where you have accounts and events, and the events are payments between the accounts. Can we go to the next slide? Yeah. So I'm now going very fast. So here you would see our tool where we see for a particular person called Bruce Rosie. And at the bottom of the screen, you see that it's actually http://bigbank.com/ and then a number. We always display things by label. And then you see the properties. And if I click, go to the next, wait a second. So what you see, okay. So here you see that this person, this is the IP address where this thing was opened. The account number, the account place, and then the people that he paid, and then under the thick gray line, the people that paid him. So under the thick gray line, all the people that, let's continue. So click on gun barrel sibling. So this, so for each payment, can this, next slide? Yeah. So for each payment, we also have a link to GeoNames, which is this database of 7 million places on Earth with latitude and longitudes. So we can deal with that. Next slide. Here you see a typical event with a sender and a receiver where the payment actually also happened in Gun Barrel City. In the next slide. So I can explore this graph on the screen by just looking at the sender and the receiver properties. Next slide. Normally I would do this as a demo, by the way. And so I can find beautiful graphs of how things relate and circles of payments. Next slide. We can zoom in and make these really large things. So you can kind of see the payment patterns and at least the relationship patterns. Next slide. And I want to almost conclude with this one because, so this is one of these queries where, and just look at the, this is a Sparkle query where we use geospatial, temporal, and social network all in one query. But just look at the English text, which says, did the most important friends of Sonia make a payment within 100 miles of Rotterdam in the last 10 years? Now, you guys have my slides, so I just would invite you to figure this out for yourself, which of these things are actually geospatial, temporal, social network analytics. Go to the next slide. Yeah, and this would be a Prolog rule that we use in this project. Yeah, where we say, well, with two accounts opened in a particular window, between minus 4800 seconds and minus 1800 seconds, where the accounts paying into group payers between the last half hour, and where the receivers are close together, the payers are close together, and if that happens, then alert and tell a human being that there is possibly a collusion going on. Next slide. And so I think with that, I almost want to conclude. So I just wanted to show you guys how we have a reason that magic predicates, Prolog, Sparkle, and rule systems. And I hope this picture kind of makes it clear how all this fits together. The next slide. And then thank you for your time. And I don't know if you want to do any questions now or whether you want to do the questions later.
I think we should hold the questions until we get to the panel discussion.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jan. That was a great introduction to the subject.
Thank you.
So So now we'd like to move on to Bill Glynn. Bill is the co-founder of WG Sigma Systems, and he's going to be speaking today on architecting intelligent real-time systems processing billions of events a day. So this sounds like it's going to be really exciting. Bill, are you unmuted?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Sounds great.
Good. So let me give you a little introduction to what I'm going to cover. Was mentioned, I co-founded a company to develop systems like I'm going to explain to you. But there's some lineage behind these systems. I was the chief technology officer for a company by the name of Amdocs that is the largest supplier of telecommunication software in the world. And what Amdocs did is they create customer care billing and provisioning systems for most of the large telecommunications companies in the world. So if you can imagine AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, Metro PCS, Bell Canada, Rogers, Vodafone, Reliance in India, I could go on and on and on. All these companies have outsourced most of their IT solutions, and in many cases, the operation of those solutions to other companies. And those other companies, largely, there's just three or four in the world, and Amdocs has the lion's share of it. So Amdocs is processing over a billion customer telecommunication subscribers, if you will, on a daily basis. So Amdocs has very, very large-scale systems. And they're very similar to what you'd find in other industries, whether it be financial services or insurance or healthcare. And so if you want to go to slide two, what you find in these organizations, whether they be a telecommunications provider like AT&T or a bank like Bank of America, is huge, huge enterprise systems, hundreds, thousands of applications basically running as transaction processing systems, running in silos. And we all know this problem. But frankly, IT hasn't really solved the problem of how do I take data, processing in all these systems, and form some cohesive collective intelligence so that what I'm doing in each of those systems is optimize across the entire enterprise versus kind of a local optimization you get in a transaction processing system. So go to the next slide, please. So this is a view of a modest-sized telco, and I'm not going to try to explain this picture, but I'm just going to point out a couple of things. So if you look at how a telco operates, And frankly, this is one of about 20 such pictures that would describe AT&T systems, and each picture is equally dense. There are literally thousands of systems involved in the online operation of a telco. But what you're probably familiar with as a customer of a telecommunications operator, like an AT&T or a Sprint, is on the far left-hand upper corner, the call centers. You call a AT&T or Sprint or whomever. You talk to a customer service rep, and data is presented to that customer service rep, or you may go into a self-care type function. And that data is being pulled usually from just three or four different systems. But behind those systems are hundreds, if not thousands, of systems. So the systems that are actually interacting with you or a customer service trip on behalf of you really doesn't have access nor this cohesive collective knowledge of everything that's going on. And in fact, as most transaction processing systems work, you have to ask it explicit questions, and it's only there for a specific purpose. So transaction processing systems generally do not know you're calling about. The CSR has to ask you, why are you calling, for example. So there's time spent in doing this stuff. There's really very little intelligence in these systems that are predictive, so they know what's going on, for example, in your account, whether it be telecommunications or, as Jan's talked about, fraud, or even when it comes down to handling data in the flow of business. There's very little intelligence looking for trends and patterns. If there is that intelligence, it's all kind of offline and done by analysts. So if you want to move to the next slide, kind of the problem and what most big organizations are trying to do today is, how do I take these massive systems that are processing, in some cases, billions of transactions a day, and add some intelligence into them? When the problem, of course, is that, and I'll take AT&T as an example, AT processes about 2 billion call detail records a day. So in other words, they're processing about a billion calls a day. And that's just events related to calls. That's not events related to customers calling in and asking questions about their account or changing their account or adding or taking equipment off of their account. That's just calls. So you're looking at, again, several billion transactions a day, which equates to, in peak times, almost 100,000 transactions a second. So how do you look at this stuff in pretty much real time, because calls have to be processed in real time, customer interactions have to be processed in real time, and add intelligence into it, add kind of a holistic understanding of what's going on with that account, maybe in a telecommunications environment, what's going on in the network that customer happens to be on right now, or the segments of the network that customer's on right now. And you can think of multiple use cases for how, when I'm interacting with a customer, I want to know how to best service that customer, what's going on with that customer, what's going on with the service I'm providing that customer. So how do I optimize that experience, and how, frankly, do I make the most revenue out of that customer when I'm talking to them, trying to upsell them, or just trying to provide them good quality of service? So when you look at these systems, and for example, Amdocs, who had about 110 different applications that were normally installed in these big telecommunications providers, we had 60 million lines of code supporting those systems. How do I unite that stuff, extract the intelligence or the data out of those systems, and then manage, say, a customer experience holistically across all of that information? It's a very daunting challenge. Let's go to the next slide. So what we did is we said, look, we've got basically 110 different transaction processing applications and frankly, very little intelligence across them, and frankly, not much integration across them, because most of these systems are built up as kind of an implementation of a specific business process or function. In many organizations, even if you're an ISV like Amdocs or AT&T for that matter, you're typically building and buying applications. So the application stack, the technology stacks vary tremendously. Even I tried my best to try to uniform this stuff and unify it with a service-oriented architecture, but there's still huge impedance mismatches in terms of how information is stored. So integrating this stuff is a huge challenge. So instead of trying to go in and integrate, in the case of Amdocs, 60 million lines of code, I built a platform over the top of the entire enterprise stack, if you will. And the architecture shown in this slide we're looking at. And the idea is to treat all of the information that's created in an enterprise as events, and assume, although many are not, but assume they're coming into you in real time, or assume you're going to go capture them and grab them and process them in real time. Now, that's not always the case. A lot of information you have to go out into these systems and extract it through ETL-type technology. But we wanted a real-time paradigm. So we adopted an event type of mechanism. And so the first thing we had to do was figure out how we're going to pull data into this new platform that's going to sit over the top of these huge environments. So we created an event collector, which was a highly scalable piece of software that ran, and I'll show you some more of the technology in a minute, that runs distributed in memory across a data grid for fault tolerance and for performance. Because again, there could be a few hundred thousand events coming into this system a second. So it had to be massively scalable. Now this is grunt programming, just to be candid with you. You know, you've got data coming in from hundreds of different sources in hundreds of different formats. And what you've got to do is grab that stuff, understand whether though that piece of data is really meaningful to you. Sometimes you need to correlate it with the next piece of data, for example, a call detail record. For those not familiar with call processing, there's always a call detail record at the beginning of a call and a call detail record at the end of a call, and you need to put those two records together to form the entire picture of a call. So your event collector needs to do those types of correlation and aggregation. Again, nothing special here, just a lot of code looking at how to format stuff, get it into a normalized form, and maybe cleanse the data a little bit, because there's a lot of duplication and there's a lot of redundancy, and you can get into a real situation of having a lot of dirty data. So you want to cleanse the data up front too. But as soon as we end up with these cleanse, normalize events, what we did is we injected them into what we architected as a decision engine. So we ingest these events, and then what we try to do is take data coming from all of these hundreds of different systems and inject that into a graph that updates the current state of the customer or subscriber, as it's known in the telecommunications space. The idea being that we always have a real-time view of the customer and the business relationship with that customer. So for any system that needs to understand what's going on with that customer, that subscriber, the equipment, the network segments that customer's using, we have that picture in real time. The system can reach out to those systems, or systems can come into this platform and say, what's going on, you know, up to the second with this customer, with their quality of service? What should I provision for them? What are their likes, their dislikes? You know, what should I upsell to them? So on and so forth. So the whole idea is all this is flowing left to right in real time. We're trying to keep a real-time view of a subscriber in a telecommunications environment. So I'll talk a little bit more about how we do all this, but just keep in mind that what we're trying to do is always have a real-time view of what's going on with that customer and how we should treat that customer. So to do that, we had to build an ontology, obviously. We had to understand what we wanted to track associated with that customer and their real-time usage of all of our network and equipment and such. So this is all based on an ontology. Now, a lot of the stuff we wanted to track and predict is what's a customer doing, why are they doing it, and if they're contacting us or if they're using our network, why are they using our network? So we needed probabilistic capabilities to do that. So many of these events may trigger the execution of a Bayesian belief network to try to predict what's the motivation behind what that customer is doing. And based on the motivation, we can figure out what we should be doing for that customer. So a lot of these events, not all of them, because some of them aren't really of interest to us, feed through a Bayesian belief network. And again, this is all done in real time. In fact, this whole pipeline will execute in typically under 200 milliseconds. usually in under 50 milliseconds, depending on how deep we have to go in some of our inferencing and such. And then all of this information is stored after we store the event itself and our inferencing around it. All of our motivational analysis is stored in a graph. So everything's connected together. And as Jan's talked about, you guys know how to navigate a triple store, for example. We would store all this in a graph and then have services into this platform where other systems could call into this platform and, again, ask the platform questions, kind of knowledge of the service in real time, if you will. Why is this customer contacting me? What should I offer this customer? What quality of service am I providing this customer right now, for example? These are typical questions that other systems would call into the system and ask. At the same time, this platform controls certain systems, so it actually takes action. So some of the events coming in would actually trigger changes to all of those systems in that very complex picture I showed you just a minute ago. So, for example, if a customer is calling in about a problem, this system may decide to just go ahead and give them a credit for that problem. And it would go out to systems like billing systems and post a credit on the account. It doesn't need a human to do that. The system will actually take action on behalf of what would traditionally be a human deciding to post a credit to the account. And more complex transactions as well, such as provisioning or shutting down services in various situations of fraud and things like this. So the whole idea is a platform that's ingesting events, feeding them through this pipeline in real time, and taking action. So it's really an event condition action paradigm that uses inferencing in the middle to decide what to do. And some of those decisions are just executed in these line of business systems to take actions, to actually change accounts, provision software, so on and so forth. Some of these inferences are used to communicate motivations and other options to a human service rep, for example, on, you know, what they are eligible to do for this customer in a given business situation, or to just give them information on why this customer may be calling so that they have essentially a knowledge base back there, and so that they don't have to play what I call the 20 questions, 20 screens game. And you've all experienced this, I'm sure. You call into a call center and they start asking you questions, and it takes them sometimes several minutes to figure out who you are, what's going on with your account, and to start correlating what's happened in the past with maybe what's going on right now, try to come to some consensus on what they should be doing. So there's a lot of navigation across transactional systems involved in that. There's a lot of knowledge in the head of the customer service rep on what to be looking at, where to go to get it, and to pull all this stuff together in their own head. And many times the service you get and really how well the company is performing is really based on the experience and knowledge of who you're talking to. So what we try to
Excuse me, Bill. What slide number are we on now? Are we still on five, or are you on six?
Yeah, still on five. So they try to codify that thinking and put it in the system. So those inferences are made by the system, and we provide those inferences to the CSR instead of the CSR having to be as knowledgeable about all the systems and all the ways to look at data. So if you look at the current slide, slide six, there's several pieces to this. One, to do it, we created a semantic concept model. And this is a model of what you would normally see for a customer in a telecommunications environment. You know, all of the accounts, the equipment, the interactions we've had with the customer but also higher level concepts like issues of whether the customer is a valuable customer or not, what kind of payment patterns we're seeing out of the customer, what's the likes and dislikes of the customer, what are their favorite genre of movies and things of this nature. So we're inferring a lot of higher level concepts and putting this in the ontology as well. And I'll show you some example or two of this. Obviously, this is a closed loop system as well. So as this system is processing this information, we're both using probabilistic analysis, actually a BBN, to decide, you know, what is going on, what is this customer, why are they contacting us, and what should we should be doing about it. And then we're making decisions based on that. So, for example, we might offer someone a product because we believe that they're interested in this genre of movies, or you know they're interested in this type of a handset because they're a heavy text user, but they don't surf the net a whole lot, for example. So you know we try to target equipment to customers. Whether they take those offers or not is feedback back into these systems. So the various systems that are sending this system events are also, of course, information that tell us whether the decisions made were good ones or not. So in other words, if we offer somebody something and they took it, then we made the right decision. If we offer somebody something and they didn't, then we know we need to tweak our model. So there's a self-learning capability in the system as well. So the machine learning aspect of this is very important. We use a champ challenger type of approach here, largely by switching BBN networks around to change the behavior of our recommendation engines and things like this. So let's go to the next slide. So here's a kind of a conceptualized view of how some of this would look. If you look in the middle, what you'll see is kind of a stylized view of a graph. And Jan showed you some other pictures of a graph in the prior session. But what we do is we build an ontology of customers. And again, what we try to do is track everything that's going on with a customer in real time, but also make a lot of inferences on what is important to the business. So as you can probably see, I know this is a bit of an eye chart, you know, we've made decisions whether John Smith is a good payer or not. And if he is, we've stored that. And we keep that updated in real time. We've made decisions around whether this person is paying on time or not, and how that trend is looking. You know, are they getting better as a payer or worse as a payer? Their usage characteristics, are they using more or less? And then, of course, we're making decisions upon those decisions as well. But we're always maintaining this in real time. And, of course, since this is a graph, everything's connected together. Every good payer in the system is connected together. Every bad payer is connected together. Every customer that's interested in a particular genre of movies or has a specific model of phone is connected as well, which, of course, gives us a whole lot of power in terms of seeing problems that are occurring, take-up rates, and, you know, things like addressing churn. You know, why are people churning? We can start to discover those patterns in this graph by tracking all this stuff. So look at how this is working. Obviously, we're collecting events from the left side to flowing to the right. All of these events are coming in. We're maintaining the graph. And then we're predicting, in this case, why a customer is calling us. So this use case in particular is around a customer interaction, a customer calling into a call center, talking to a customer service rep. What this system would do is as soon as the call comes in, the front-end system that's servicing the CSR is going to call this back-end system, and this back-end system is going to tell the CSR why we think this customer is calling. We're predicting the motivation behind the customer's interaction. And for most North American telcos, about 35 different motivations cover 97 to 98% of the traffic into a call center. And I've given you a snippet here on the right side of the predictive motivations why a customer is calling. We rank order those, and we supply that to the customer service rep saying, this is why we think the customer's calling. We don't give them the whole list. We give them the top three or four, rank ordered. And for each of those, we literally tell the CSR what to do. So we try to give the CSR a one-click-to-action type of paradigm so they don't have to ask the customer 20 questions. They can ask the question, are you calling about your plan overage? Or are you calling about the prorate on your bill? Or are you calling about the fact that, you're not texting? We know you're not texting. We've been monitoring you, and you normally, send hundreds of texts a day, and all of a sudden we saw that you're not texting. So the idea here, of course, is if you look at a customer the size of AT&T, they have 50,000 customer service reps. Believe it or not, AT&T has the largest union shop in the United States. An average call is about 8 minutes long. You can do the math. AT&T spends a few billion dollars a year paying for customer service. If you can take some time away from those calls, then you can save AT&T millions of dollars a year. So that's what this is for, to understand why a customer is calling, get to the answer as quickly as possible, shorten that call, and try to prevent repeat calls. So you can do that on a reactive basis with this application. In other words, you wait till a customer calls you. But as you can see, since we're predicting why customers are calling in, and we're predicting it every time anything changes on that account, any action that happens on that account, any call that's placed, any billing function, any interaction with that customer on a self-care portal or whatever, we're tracking in real time what's going on and predicting what's going on. So we can also be proactive. We can start seeing things that are occurring, notify the customer of an overage that's about to occur or a problem, or that, again, maybe their text messaging isn't working. We detect the fact that the reason is because they're on the wrong firmware level in their phone, and we can over the air download that latest version and restore their texting service. So again, the system is really trying to add intelligence over the top of a whole universe of operational systems. If you go to the next slide.
Bill, you're running way over.
Oh, I thought I was going to get a warning.
I gave you a time check at 20 minutes, but for some reason you didn't seem to respond.
Okay, I'm sorry I didn't hear. So I'll finish up.
You're running a couple minutes over already.
Okay, so from a scalability perspective, obviously the issue is you've got to be able to federate all this processing. We did it in a data grid. You've got to partition your data set to handle these types of loads. So the technology stack is very important that you can federate this stuff. Go to the next slide, and I'll try to finish this up. What is extremely important in these systems, and I can't overstress this, is all the stuff that Jan's talked about, Sparkle, Prolog, you have to be able to do that stuff. But a system like this has hundreds, if not thousands, of rules in it. And you need business analysts to be able to manage those rules. So you've got to put a front end on top of these applications that give a business analyst, someone who is not extremely technical, but does understand the business and does understand what business transactions and motivations they're trying to implement, give them the ability to manage this stuff. So we developed our own rules capability over the top of this that actually generates Sparkle behind it. So we tried to give a very, analyst-friendly experience so that this system can be managed by, non-IT people. So go to the next slide. And the stack to do it, again, I obviously don't have time to go through this, but it's a pretty complex stack of technology. You have to deal a lot with integration of data, obviously, ETL stuff, a lot of rules. We used an in-memory data grid to give us fault tolerance and performance. A lot of the data will come in unstructured, so you have to be able to deal with that using things like Solr, Yuma to annotate software, VBN in real time. Norsys Netic is probably your best choice for that. And at the end of the day, of course, the challenge here is just integrating the stack. And this is what I spent really the last 5 years in perfecting, is how to put all this stuff together so that you can push, you know, that volume of traffic through a system like this. Okay, sorry, I ran over. I didn't hear your 20-minute warning, so I'll conclude at this.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bill. That was great. So now we move on to the last talk today. Mitch Coker and I go back a really long way. We've been collaborating on semantic web technologies basically since the semantic web was started. We were part of the original BAML project, and we've collaborated on cognitive radio, among other things. And so today, Mitch Coker, who is the president of a company, Vistology Incorporated, as well as a professor in electrical and computer engineering at Northeastern University, is going to be speaking about the use of OWL and rules for cognitive radio, and he'll also be explaining the concept of cognitive radio for those who are not familiar with this. So, Mitch, are you on right now?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, we can hear you now, so go ahead. Be sure to tell us the slide numbers, and I'll give you a 20-minute time check.
Okay, thanks. Okay, hello, everyone. So my name is Mitch Coker. Ken introduced me already, so no need to talk about myself, but I just wanted to start from where we used to have a project funded by NSF to Northeastern University. That's where Ken and I were PIs on that project. And in that project, we worked on a language for radios. So radios, when you use radios, first of all, what is a radio? So you can think of your Android phone as a radio, two-way, and also, but in most applications that we are dealing with, these are like soldier radios. So we were working on this language, and we proposed to NSF that we would develop a language for radios to talk about their stuff. It's not about communicating messages, user messages, but radios have to talk. There's stuff too, essentially communications related. So that's how it was all started. And then through this effort, eventually I got associated with the Wireless Innovation Forum. I'll mention this later on, and also with IEEE standardization effort, which is called P1900.5. So in this talk, I'd like to give kind of a brief introduction to several topics where I'm trying to kind of promote the use of semantic technology, in particular OWL and rules, not only at Northeastern, but also in the IEEE and in the Wireless Innovation Forum. So on page two, I'm mentioning just RF spectrum shortage. This is a problem, a real problem, because spectrum, which is communication spectrum, you can think about whatever gigahertz you are using when you are communicating with your phone, is pretty crowded. And it's getting more and more crowded because we have more and more phones and all kinds of radios. Not only phones, but also microphones and so on. So the issue is that it is a very expensive also resource, which is at this point supervised by the government, in particular by the FCC. The government sells this space, essentially looks like selling air, but collecting billions of dollars. Now someone buys this spectrum, and then the question is, what does he use with it? In particular, like Verizon's and such AT&T's buy some spectrum and they say, oh, this is ours. But the question is whether they will use this to the best way or they can or not. That's a question. So if we move to slide number three, this is a picture that if you people who talk about cognitive radios show, they show that spectrum is pretty crowded for one. And then on the left upper left corner, you can see how spectrum is allocated to particular users. And then at the bottom on the left, you can see that some frequencies are sometimes used, sometimes not used, depending on the time and on the location. So the fact that Verizon has some spectrum allocation or that TV has some spectrum to them, well, at night, TV is not really transmitting that much. So this spectrum might be available to some other users. So the question is, could other users use this opportunistically? And that's how we come to the issue of cognitive radio, which is slide four. So on slide four, I'm introducing the definition of what cognitive radio is. It was defined by John Mitola, who at that time was doing his PhD thesis at Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm. Part of his licentiate thesis, he came up with this definition that's a radio essentially, which is cognitive radio is a radio in which communication systems are aware of their environment and internal state, which means their own state, and can make decisions about the radio operating behavior based on that information and predefined objectives. And then later on, this definition was picked up by other organizations, among others, Wireless Innovation Forum, which is a forum of companies, and then by the IEEE too. So if you go to slide number five, what I'm trying to say is that when you hear cognitive radio these days, most of the times people mean, oh, this is a radio that can sense whether specific band of spectrum is occupied or not, and if not, it can use it opportunistically. Well, this is one of the issues, perhaps the primary issue, because this is like very well supported by the current business. But there are some other aspects that John Mitola put into the cognitive radio, like, for instance, that the radio should be queryable by other radios, for instance, and it's not possible at this point in a sense, because although radio keeps information whatever it has, but if you ask the radio, it doesn't know what it knows. so this knowledge is not made explicit in the radio, and so therefore those radios don't look that smart. If you ask someone and say, oh, What's your weight? And the person says, well, I have weight, but I don't know what it is. Well, that's okay sometimes, but for radios, some questions are very important to answer, and radios usually don't know the answers. They don't have a language for asking and for replying. So that's slide number five. So now going to slide number six, the question is, how should the spectrum be managed? There are various philosophies about this, and one of the philosophies says, oh, everybody should have the same access. So in other words, that the spectrum should be allocated in a fair way, which means everybody has the same priority. But that's somewhat questionable. In particular, for instance, if there is an emergency and some emergency responders need spectrum to decide whether they need to send an ambulance or go and put down some fire. Well, so should those guys have higher priority than two people who are chatting about their dinner plans? So some people say yes, some people say no. It should be not particularly fair. Some people should have higher priority, some lower. Well, it's not that easy. Now, if you have talking priorities, you need policies. And so, therefore, we come to the point where radios should obey or follow some policies. So that's one of the issues that cognitive radio is all about, that those radios are policy-based radios rather than just protocol-based radios. Not just, of course, they need protocols, but the protocol should have enough flexibility so that they can understand policies and those policies and execute those policies. The big issue here is that radios need to be certified to be admitted to the market. So the issue is that if we want to implement policies, then whenever the policy changes, should the radio be recertified or not? If it needs to be recertified, then that's a big pain for the manufacturer because it's a slow process. It's reviews, paperwork, and what have you, testing, and so on. So maybe we should move to the next slide, which is slide number 7. As part of the various efforts, it became kind of clear that a policy-based radio might be a solution here. So in this slide, I'm showing an architecture of such a policy-based radio system. This architecture is very much similar to the architecture that has been accepted by the IEEE, not as a standard, but as part of the standard, but that's listed in the standard just for informational for information, not as a requirement. But as you can see here, on the left-hand side, above, you have a global policy repository. This is the repository where the FCC or the military, whoever needs to define policies, they define those policies. Some authoritative sources define policies. Now, so the radio should be able to ingest those policies and put this in its local policy repository and then use them. So how do they use it? So that those policies are shown within a policy conformance reasoner, which means that whenever a radio tries to transmit, it should contact the policy conformance reasoner and ask for a request. Can I transmit this or now and at this frequency with this power at this time or not? So the those requests for transmission are formulated in what is shown here as a system strategy reasoner. So the system strategy reasoner manipulates the controls the operation of the radio, and whenever the radio needs to transmit, it needs to invoke the policy conformance reasoner or PCR, and then if the answer is yes or no, the message is being sent via the radio platform to the antenna. As you can see at the bottom of this, there is a sensor shown, which is possibly a device that measures whether a specific policy is occupied or a specific spectrum band is occupied or not. So it's kind of similar in a sense, like in the internet, listen before and then talk. So the only difference here is that in the internet, you don't have this kind of priorities assigned, as far as I know at least. But if Verizon buys this spectrum, then obviously Verizon, the controls, should be able to have this to its own use. Those users who are Verizon subscribers and are then termed PUs or primary users, and those who try to use this spectrum are called secondary users. And those secondary users should not interfere with the primary users, because otherwise, why would Verizon pay for it? So that's in some cases, they use sensing of the spectrum before they start transmitting. Okay, so here's an example on slide number 8. There's an example of a policy. It says a node can transmit in the frequency range 350 megahertz to 370 megahertz in locations between latitude and longitude and so on. So a radio should be able to say, here is my ID, and then I want to transmit that operation type, this range, this location, and the policy reason returns, okay, this allowed for some reason, because, for instance, in this case, it has to transmit in the wrong location or something like that. So the question is, when it comes to the implementation of a policy-based radio, the question is, what should be used for a language? What language should it be represented? And so, first of all, Java is not really liked there because the communications community doesn't think of Java as a real-time kind of embedded system language. So they prefer to use C, C++. However, okay, whenever you make a modification to the policy, you would have to recertify the radio, so it's not good. So the second option could be to use some kind of XML-based language without semantics, and then the issue is that whenever you need to add new tags, then you need to again recertify the radio because you would need to develop some additional procedures. So what we propose here is that we propose to use a language with formal semantics like OWL, and possibly rules. In that case, the hope is that policies, that radios would not need to be recertified after the admittance of a specific inference engine or specific policy engine to by the FCC. And in that case, policies can change, but the radio is bound to the language and not to the specific policies. So obviously it needs an ontology. So I'm showing on slide number 10, CRO, which is Cognitive Radio Ontology. And this ontology was developed by the Wireless Innovation Forum. It was approved and voted out as an approved, not a standard, but a document. And this document is downloadable from the WIN Forum website, which I show in here. And then, so then what happened is Wireless Innovation Forum does not, is not a standardization body. So Wireless Innovation Forum signed a memorandum of understanding with the IEEE so that whatever it develops, it transfers to the IEEE for standardization. And that's what happened. So Wireless Innovation Forum has submitted a proposal, made a submission to the IEEE P1905 standardization of effort. What came in this standard was that it was clear that not only kind of logical reasoning, or logical standard logical reasoning, or first order logic reasoning is needed, but also some model logic is needed. In particular, I'm moving now to slide number 11, because it's not enough to say that it's that the radio is transmitting or not transmitting, but the question is the should or should not, or should obey, or should allow, should be disallowed, and this kind of stuff. So that clearly goes beyond it goes into the deontic kind of ontologies. So. As part of that submission, a deontic action ontology was proposed where permissible, obligatory, optional, prohibited actions by the radio were considered. Okay, and then on slide number 12, I am showing just the top-level classes of that ontology. Again, they were submitted to P1905 and are under consideration right now. Obviously, we also need the policy ontology, and this is slide number 13. Again, this is just the top level of the policy ontology, where policies are collections of rules, and those rules involve actions, and it shows here the deontic actions, the actions that involve some entities, both agents, like those who actively seek spectrum and possibly spectrum as object too. So on slide 14, I'm showing this two conversations example where, as you can see here, two firemen, I guess, or whatever, first responders, say, interact via voice, but at the same time, the radios talk about their own stuff. With their stuff, this is, what is your multipath structure, for instance? What is your sense signal-to-noise ratio? So these are the issues that are of interest to the communications, to the radios themselves, not to the to the first responders. Okay, so then now the question is, on next slide, which is slide 15, what we are stressing here is that current radios are limited in a sense that it cannot just say send queries and responses just to any question. The only things that are encoded in protocols, that's what they can send. So, for instance, we try to extend this and actually show that radios can exchange information in a language like OWL. And we demonstrated this. It was done by at Northeastern University, but one of our students, Rachel Lee, and so she demonstrated this, and Jakub Moska also participated in this. They demonstrated this at the Wireless Innovation Forum Technical Conference. I don't have time to discuss this, but here I'm advertising the book that Rachel, with my help, wrote on slide number 16. So if anybody is interested, obviously you can read there. As I said before, on slide number 17, current radios are limited really to whatever the protocol allows it to send. So it's not possible to send more. So on slide number 19, I'm showing some issue between XML versus OWL, and we are having discussions. So on the one hand, those who are in ontologies, obviously to them, okay, we use ontologies, fine. But the issue is when you go to communications radio engineers, they say, well, for one, we don't know OWL, it's difficult, and so on and so forth. They are more familiar with XML, and this is bias. So Rachel has done this comparison of XML versus OWL.
Yes. Mitch, time check, 20 minutes.
Okay, all right, I should be fine. Thanks. So it shows that using OWL, you don't need to send all the information because part of the information can be inferred locally. So moving on to slide 19, here are some examples of inferences that can be drawn by a cognitive radio. So in slide 20, again, I'm showing this essentially the scenario in which two radios communicate about their communication mechanisms and which one to choose and how to adapt using some facts and rules and obviously an ontology. Just to add a little bit more to this, what we have done on slide number 21, I'm showing an example of a PhD thesis that was completed last December, I believe. In this thesis, one of our students, he developed a demo and implementation of a scenario in which one radio sends a description of a waveform, essentially using waveform or protocol to the other radio, and they were able to use that, to reconstruct this protocol from the description. The description was using OWL and rules. So the other radio was able to reconstruct this protocol, and they started communicating. It was demonstrated. It's working. So on slide number 22, I'm showing this kind of advertising the work of the Wireless Innovation Forum, and I'm chairing this group, which is called MLM, Modeling Language for Mobility, where we are developing this ontology and we're working on policies and rules and use cases. Slide number 23 shows just the Wireless Innovation Forum, advertising Wireless Innovation Forum. Slide number 24 shows that MLM's goals are way larger than just spectrum. That in this case we are showing here so the MLM language is inside. It is supposed to be standardized by IEEE in 1900, but it should also kind of be compatible with other standards. Inside of this, there are small circles which describe all kinds of things that those radios could talk about. So these are subjects of discussion between whom. So these are the guys on the outside, the tool vendors, the component providers, software developers, and so on. So those, not just radios, but various companies are associated with this could use this language. And as I said before on slide 25, this work has been now handed over to the IEEE, and which is working now on standardizing this language, which would include most likely OWL. I propose to use OWL2RL and also rules. So on slide 26, I'm showing you more information about the IEEE 19005 standard. If anybody wants to contact Matt Sherman, his email is listed here, is the chair of this working group. So the summary of what we submitted to what Wireless Innovation Forum submitted to IEEE, as I said before, we submitted OWL2RL for the ontology language, and we submitted CRO that we developed at the Wireless Information Forum as the ontology. We also suggested to use RIF for rules and the deontic policy ontology, as I showed before. So essentially, that's all I wanted to say. So slide number 28 just summarizes kind of our efforts, which is promoting the use of OWL and rules and ontologies, including the deontic ontology, for the purpose of developing cognitive radios.
Great. Thanks, Mitch. That was really a pretty comprehensive talk on the subject. Now, at this point, I'd like to open up the session to questions to the panel, and hopefully we can get a discussion going about all of the various topics that have been presented. We've seen a number of use cases of ontologies and rules in action and in industry. So, would anybody like to start off the discussion? There was a question on the chat to Bill. Robin, you asked something? Oh, I believe that was answered on the chat as well. So,
Peter, I put a response into the chat. Would you like for me to elaborate?
Robin is.
Yes, please.
Please do.
Yeah, so what Robin asked is why we threw Cassandra into that technology stack I very briefly covered instead of just putting time series data into the graph. And of course, the graph could hold time series data, but we try to keep the graph as lean and mean as possible because understand the volumes I was talking about, it costs a lot of money to run these systems. So what we were trying to do is keep the graphs really holding relevant information for the inferencing we were doing pretty much in real time. And if you look at a lot of the time series data, it gets old and stale pretty quickly. So we start aggregating it and summarizing it to see trends. But a lot of that stuff can be done offline because we're collecting data all the time, and we need to refresh our aggregation and our the regression analysis, which is typically the analysis we would be doing with that stuff. So it's just easier to throw it into another database like Cassandra, run R against it, and just throw it away once you get the result. Store the result back into the graph so that we have the result we need in real time versus trying to do the regression analysis on the same platform, if you will, from a hardware perspective. And then we don't have to clean the graph up either. So, part of this is keeping these systems cleansed, if you will. And you don't want, hundreds of thousands of just entries of call durations or things like that in the graph when you could put it someplace else and do it offline.
Thanks. Michael has his hand up.
I guess I had a specific question. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, for Mitch, and then a more general question. So particularly with Mitch, you have this cognitive radio ontology that has some deontic sounding concepts, permissible action and things like this. But how do you actually use the ontology? Because that doesn't even come close to capturing any kind of deontic semantics. So how do you actually use the distinction between the different classes of actions in a deontic sense?
Okay, so can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So first of all, what we submit, that's a submission to P1900.5 to use it. It doesn't mean we're using this already. So that's that, to make it clear. Second, obviously we could go to Model Logics and try to implement Model Logics, but then we'd really have to go outside of OWL. So what we are doing here, we are essentially kind of approximating Model Logic. So first of all, you're right. It's not deontic logic yet, right? So the issue here is that for instance, as I showed in this ontology, you need to classify particular actions into these classes. And so once you classify them, then you can associate policies with the particular actions, all right?
Extra logical in a way then.
Right. Yeah. So it's not, because otherwise we were thinking about this, again, internal at Vistology, it's not IEEE I'm saying now, about what we could possibly do with this, but it sounds like we would have to go then beyond OWL and possibly go to like quadruple representation rather than the triple, where you would have every fact also have some modality, but that would be much more.
can I ask just a related question then to all the presenters?
Yes, go ahead.
People in each of the presentations, different kinds of queries were presented, different kinds of inferences that people could do, but in a way they were either almost like just Sparkle queries. Can each of the presenters kind of give a specific example where there was like some significant reasoning being done on OWL axioms or rules, like in particular axioms, say that were being used beyond just a Sparkle query, that where you could just say have a set of triples and that's what your inference is. So like real axioms of an ontology that are being used are almost like necessary in order to actually make a particular kind of inference.
Who would like to respond to that? In fact, we should have each person respond. John, how about you?
One project I didn't talk about today was very interesting. It was where we're dealing with a company that takes media streams, where a media stream is defined as some combinations of, say, MP4, MP3s for the video part, various audio streams, and then the subtitles and additional meta information, program information, and they have to turn that into different formats for different cable companies or network stations. And so what they did is they built a huge ontology of all Okay, sorry. And then what they have to do is they have all these hardware boxes, and now they more software boxes that they kind of put in the pipeline to go from this complex input package to a complex output package that it can to somewhere else. And they were programming it all in Java. And so all the knowledge about the constraints and which box you can line up to another box was all done in completely procedurally. So what we did there was they created an OWL ontology that looked at all the types of media that you have and the subtypes, all the constraints from going from one input, from one format, whether it's audio or video, to the next format. And so so this is an OWL ontology with, where the, both the data types and the constraints were specified in OWL. But of course then OWL as a reasoning engine couldn't do much with that because how do you use OWL to kind of program a series of transformations to go from input to output. So what we did is we used Prolog to compile the OWL description into Prolog functors, and then we did the same thing for the constraints, and then we ran like a shortest path between input and output, a desired output, and then we get multiple transformation paths consisting of multiple single transformations. But in that path, we still talk about, say, a types of information or subproperties, especially types of media streams, I would say. So this was kind of an example of a project where everything was specified declaratively in OWL, but in order to make it work, we had to write a whole Prolog program around it to kind of execute it. And we still would use some reasoning, especially around the types of media, for example. Does that make sense?
Yes, thanks.
Yeah?
Okay, so...
Mitch, do you have a comment about this?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm trying to answer the question. So the question is, where is reasoning used? So in the case of policy-based radio, the main inference is whether a specific transmission satisfies the conditions that for which a particular transmission would be allowable or not. So that's the main inference that needs to be done. And there is no so first of all, there must be a policy. So in our case, the policy is essentially represented as a class. So the question is whether a specific transmission would be classified as RDF type of this class. So that's the reasoning that is involved. Now, an example I showed on slide number 8, I showed an example of a very simple policy, which that's oversimplistic, obviously, that a node can transmit in the frequency range between 350 and 370 megahertz in locations between latitude and so on. So the question is, if the radio submits a request and says, okay, I want to transmit at this, and my location is this and this, and my range is this and this, should I be able to transmit? And the answer is, in this case, no. So that inference must be done. So this is oversimplistic, obviously, and in this rule, you don't really see too much of OWL axioms, although actually there are axioms here because the reasoning about range, so as a data type, can be done in OWL. And this inference can be done in OWL fully, not even rules. But on slide number 19, I believe, let me see, slide number 19. Yeah, right. So slide number 19, I showed many examples of where inference is involved. So second bullet is whether requested frequencies, bands, times, and transmission locations, power levels satisfy particular policies. So that was the example I just discussed. Other issues of interest are whether particular frequency bands are contiguous, overlapping, covering. So again, that's inference that can be probably done in OWL. So now you could have descriptions or responsibilities of a user who uses this particular radio, And the question is, you need to infer what kind of role this user is assigned to, and in that case, infer whether this user has priority or not. For instance, fireman or emergency responder, and this kind. Next bullet is security requirements. For instance, if this is some kind of classified communication, the question is, what if someone has classification so-and-so? How can we check, test whether this person has this kind of credentials and therefore is allowed to talk, and so on. So there are lots of examples where actual inference is needed. And we, in our examples, in the scenario that I discussed about, the rules were not terribly sophisticated, but nevertheless, OWL was transferred on the wire, in the air, between two radios, and we were using GNU radios platform. The only thing is that GNU radios, essentially the computer is a laptop, but the hardware was real radio, and they were exchanging OWL messages, encoded in OWL, and then inference engines were on each of the nodes, and the inference engine had to infer what to do next. So should I increase, decrease, and by some particular knobs, by how much? So we did this inference.
Bill, do you have anything to add? Okay. We have another hand up, Bob.
Yes, can you hear me?
Okay, yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I guess, first of all, I'd like to say how pleased I am to see logic being used for practical applications. It's something that many of us have looked forward to for many years, and it's finally coming to fruition. One area of the use of logic which hasn't been brought up is the resurgence of Datalog and a number of companies that are using Datalog technology, which is a bit like logic programming, restricted to not have function symbols for the most part. But on the other hand, although we can see logic coming to practical applications, these three presentations have also demonstrated something a little less satisfactory, I would say, the fact that production rules and Sparkle and other related approaches don't obviously have a coherent logical relationship to logic programming in particular. And it seems to me almost disgraceful that the community of researchers hasn't managed to find a way of unifying, reconciling the different logics that these different systems are using. So I think a little more attention to this problem is worthy. And it's a little upsetting in a sense to theoreticians in particular that so little concern has been shown about this problem. I wonder if the presenters have ever considered this issue themselves. And I hand over to you now from that point.
Anybody in the audience might be interested in chiming in on this as well. Who would like to respond?
I could ask a question about his question, and that is, from a practical perspective, where do you see the real problem in this lack of coordination?
Okay, your presentation is a good example where you showed the hundreds and thousands of different systems that might be involved in a particular organization. The data log company LogicBlocks makes a big point, and maybe it's just a marketing point, about replacing many of these systems by a single uniform logic-based approach. And it seems to me, whether they're right or wrong, we do need exactly what they're planning or proposing to provide, namely a much more uniform approach where even though we might implement particular subsystems in a specialized manner, nonetheless, the whole collection of systems can be seen in a uniform logical interpretation. So, I would recommend you look at the LogicBlocks marketing materials, because I'm not sure to what extent their actual systems live up to their marketing claims. But basically what they're saying is your hundreds and thousands of different systems can be replaced by a single uniform logic-based approach. In their case, they propose to use a data log approach. And I'm not sure I would totally agree with them in that respect, but nonetheless, I think it's shameful that at least the research community hasn't concerned itself with doing something about the conflicting approaches that we find in these different paradigms. It means that you need to integrate many different heterogeneous systems with different semantics, or should I say no semantics, when in fact it might theoretically at least be possible to replace them by a single uniform system with a logic-based unifying framework. That's it. That's my answer to your question.
Right. And Peter Yip here, if I may interrupt, at least the person who spoke just now is Hanson. So I suggest, since none of us know all the voices, please identify yourself before going into details. Also, Hanson and Ken, both your lines are introducing noises, so if you could mute your line on your own side when you're not speaking, that would be great.
But actually, we've reached the 2:30, so I believe we've run out of time at this session. So
we can go on for a couple more. Yeah, there's one more hand. Maybe Mitch would be the last one to comment.
Okay, one last comment, Mitch.
Yes. So you cannot hear me?
We can now.
Ah, okay. All right. Thank you. So I'm not trying to be insensitive to the purely logical approach, but I'm afraid that there's this issue kind of whether we want to be pure logicians or engineers, and I'm an engineer definitely. So I would probably turn this kind of complaint to logicians. It's always, you know, hardware or software problem, or logic or engineering problem. The issue is if we were able to express everything that we need in OWL, then I think Bob, I guess, spoke before, but probably would say, oh, it's okay, because OWL is kind of pure logic. Unfortunately, we can't. So we need to go to something else. So the approach we are proposing is kind of minimalistic, where we use OWL2RL, which kind of allows for adding rules. However, obviously, we can very easily violate the consistency here by adding rules in a very kind of ad hoc way. So that's an issue. And another issue that we're struggling with is the monotonicity, which was not really discussed today. And that's a big deal. It's a big problem. We are dealing with this at this point by some kind of again, very engineering approach, which means we reload the database and do the inference over again so that we don't violate the monotonicity constraints. So we are not really, neglecting this, but that's what the logicians gave us. So I tried to read papers about how rules and OWL can live happily together, and I don't think I've seen a perfect solution for this happily ever after. So that's my comment.
Okay, clearly we haven't exhausted this issue. Hopefully we can continue this offline on the mailing list for the Ontolog Forum. And I think it's appropriate then now to adjourn this meeting and hopefully invite everyone to come to the next meeting in this Ontolog mini-series on rules and reasoning. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for coming. Thanks to the speakers and panel particularly. And the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.